You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I am doing great. There's no war visible outside of my window right now. That's better than a lot of people can say.
You know, it may stay that way because you're in Spain, the one place in Europe where the leader has had the wisdom not to say, I'm joining the U.S. in this war. And in fact, it said quite the opposite. God bless him, has actually brought up the subject of international law. I don't know where you find leaders of that caliber, but we don't seem to have any here in America. Anyway, congratulations on that. Hey, another thing I want to congratulate you on is I have a newfound respect for the Russian people because we should say you're, of course, of Russian origin. You're now in Spain. When you guys invade a country, you come up with a story and you stick with it, right? It's like the Ukraine is oppressing ethnic Russians. NATO is using Ukraine as a platform to threaten Russia. Here we go. And you just keep saying that, you know? Our leaders, as you may have noticed, have a diversity of stories to explain why Trump decided to start a huge and ever-spiraling war. And I don't know. I mean, should we quickly review them for people that haven't been paying attention?
Let's do, yeah. There is, by the way, the Russian reaction that I see online to the story, not even the stories, but like the phrases thrown out by administration is a lot of them do seem like exact quotes from something that our leaders said at the beginning of the Ukrainian war.
Really? Like what?
Hex, the closest one is that I saw is Hexet saying, we did not start this war, we're finishing it. And this is like a tagline that's been repeated over and over and over again about the Ukraine war by the Russian side.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe many wars use this motif.
Yeah.
But for me, this is Ukraine.
Well, in a certain sense, yes. I mean, everyone always says I didn't start this in some sense. Even if they admit they threw the first punch, they talk about a grievance that entitled them to do that. So, yeah, that's kind of the story of human history. But it wouldn't shock me if Hegseth, I'm sure he has a certain kind of admiration for Putin. Wouldn't surprise me if he's checked out the script. But so, yeah, I mean, it's about denying them of nukes, supposedly. Iran, I mean, makes no sense because they were offering, you know, what would have absolutely, you know, a deal that would have certainly done that. And it is supposedly about liberating the Iranian people. For a while, that was it. It was about regime change. But then it wasn't about that when Trump realized regime change certainly wasn't going to happen in the immediate aftermath, which I think he kind of thought might magically happen after they killed Khamenei. Then it was about, wiping out the conventional military capacity that threatens us, even though, of course, it doesn't. Iran doesn't have a single weapon that could reach the United States. And then, I mean, my favorite, I probably missed some, but my favorite is the new Rubio explanation. We knew Israel was going to attack, and we knew that then they would attack us. And if we didn't attack them first, well, then, I don't know, trouble would happen, as in contrast to what has happened, of course. But the funny thing about that is it's kind of a ridiculous thing to assume. I mean, we'll never know because what happened was the U.S. joined Israel, not just in attacking, but in killing the leader of the country. There used to be kind of a norm against that, even in war, you know. Wipe that, the defense minister, I think the head of the IRGC. It's just, you know, so we'll never know because the U.S. said, yeah, we're, you know, it's a little odd. If your goal is to neutralize the Iranian retaliation for an Israeli strike, it's just a little odd to choose to say, hey, we are with Israel in killing your leader. Maybe that'll reduce the amount of blowback we get from this war, right? I mean, that's just nutsville. I just, I don't understand why I said that. I mean, and the other reason it's so weird is Iran has been notable for, if nothing else, the incredible restraint shown even until now, even when the U.S. has attacked it. When we killed Soleimani.
Just very recently.
Yeah. When we killed Soleimani, who was the head of the IRGC and the most important military commander, he was like their chief geopolitical strategist. We assassinated him in Iran. And what they did was they notified us, apparently, through second party, that they were going to hit these like barracks in Iraq so we could clear out the troops. And the troops were in a bomb shelter. And it was a token strike. And then the strike in June was essentially token. So it's just, I mean, Rubio, I also don't know why he wants to catalyze, well, the narrative already had a lot of momentum that Israel dragged us into this war. But traditionally, people like Rubio have discouraged that kind of talk. I mean, he's basically a neocon who claims to have changed his colors. I think I never believed it. And I think, last year has given us plenty of reason to doubt that he changed his colors. But that's like been the accusation against the neocons, right? Like, they are in league with Israel. They want wars. Israel wants to get us into wars. And neocons are, you know, the agents of that enterprise. And now, like, Rubio is encouraging. I have a theory for why they said most of the other stuff, kind of just flailing and let's say this, let's say that. This one, I really don't get. But I don't know. Marco is a person of great depths that I can't purport to understand, I guess.
Should we play that clip for context? It's like a minute long. I have Rubio.
Yeah, I do.
I was fascinated when I saw this morning.
The United States is conducting an operation to eliminate the threat of Iran's short-range ballistic missiles and the threat posed by their Navy, particularly to naval assets. That is what it is focused on doing right now, and it's doing quite successfully. I'll leave it to the Pentagon and the Department of War to discuss the tactics behind that and the progress that's being made. That is the clear objective of this mission. The second question that's been asked is, why now? Well, there's two reasons why now. The first is it was abundantly clear that if Iran came under attack by anyone, the United States or Israel or anyone, they were going to respond and respond against the United States. The orders had been delegated down to the field commanders. It was automatic. And in fact, it bears to be true because, in fact, within an hour of the initial attack on the leadership compound, the missile forces in the south and in the north, for that matter, had already been activated to launch. In fact, those had already been pre-positioned. The third is the assessment that was made that if we stood and waited for that attack to come first before we hit them, we would suffer much higher casualties. And so the president made the very wise decision. We knew that there was going to be an Israeli action. We knew that that would precipitate an attack against American forces. And we knew that if we didn't preemptively go after them before they launched those attacks, we would suffer higher casualties and perhaps even higher those killed. And then we would all be here answering questions about why we knew that and didn't act.
So we had to strike first because we knew Israel was going to strike them. And if Israel strikes them, Iran would respond by attacking our bases.
Yeah.
Well, so he didn't make this decision.
He said we knew if anyone struck Iran, they would retaliate against the U.S., which is nuts. Maybe he just misspoke. There is an element of truth to what he said, which is that in the wake of the June attack where they did this kind of decapitation strike where they wiped out a lot of the top military leadership and stuff. I do think Iran set up a system whereby even if there was decapitation, the military command structure would be decentralized enough so that retaliation would proceed. There are commanders. I don't know whether the division is regional or functional or what, but commanders, different commanders who have the authority to strike. That said, if the U.S. had nothing to do with the strike, they wouldn't hit the U.S. And relatedly, we had the leverage to keep Israel from striking. One thing I absolutely guarantee you of is that if Trump had said to Bibi, we are not going to deploy our missile defense systems on your behalf. If you hit Iran, Israel would not have hit Iran. Okay? Now, some people go, wait, Trump couldn't have said that. Why couldn't he have said it? You know, what you mean is in American politics, you're not allowed to do anything but join Israel in wars, right? I mean, that's the subtext of a claim like that. It's absolutely leverage that would have worked. And, you know, Trump has shown in other contexts that he's more willing than other presidents to play a little tough with Bibi. Every once in a while, he'll do that in a way that Biden wouldn't have. But anyway, there's no doubt that that would have worked. And there's certainly no doubt that even if it had failed and the U.S. had conveyed to Iran that it was not deploying its defenses on Israel's behalf, that, you know, you would not have seen this all out. You know, they're now attacking like U.S. embassies in Saudi Arabia, in, I think, maybe Kuwait. You know, you wouldn't have seen this. So of course, the other thing is, like, if you knew that the system was prepared to launch a broad retaliatory campaign and was robust enough to do that even after decapitation, why didn't you go to extremes to stop Israel rather than joining them in triggering this thing? You know, we have not, I don't think we've heard anything approaching the truth about, well, Rubio may have come close to the truth. I don't know. But, you know, if the question is, why did we really do this? You have to go to a whole nother level from this kind of barrage of internally contradictory administration rhetoric, I think.
So there are multiple narratives. This one got strengthened by these remarks from Rubio. And this is, I saw some of Tucker's monologue today.
What did he say? I've got a feeling I know.
But it's Israel's war. That's the thumbnail language, and that's most of what I've heard. I haven't listened to the full thing. The only reason this is happening is Netanyahu wants this war, and he managed to drag the U.S. into it. So that's one narrative. On the other hand, the U.S. has been active in the Middle East for decades. It's not like a random thing suddenly with Trump or like in the last 5 years or something. Is there a coherent U.S. foreign policy as it relates to the Middle East that's been advancing in the last 30 years? Or you as the veteran foreign policy reporter? Well,
first of all, what I'd say is new over the last 5 years is the extent of U.S. participation in Israeli military adventures.
Okay.
I guess it starts with Biden kind of putting our air defenses completely at Israel's disposal, even in a war that they just basically started in that exchange with Iran. And then Trump, it was in June when for the first time, we didn't participate merely in the sense of aiding Israel's defense. After they attacked, we actually joined them in the attack. That was new. That's never happened in American history. Mm-hmm. And then this, where we don't just wait for Israel to start it, we plan it with them, and we say, yeah, we would like to share responsibility for killing the leader of a very big country with a lot of weapons that's in a part of the world where, if it caught fire, that would be a huge problem. You know, that's good thinking. I don't know. So as for why, I mean, it's interesting. Traditionally, to explain U.S. behavior in the Middle East, you've gotten I have regular conversations on this podcast with kind of restrainers on the left. In fact, this Thursday, I'm having one with Danny Bessner and Derek Davison of the American Prestige podcast, and restrainers on the right. By restrainers, I mean they're against military adventure by and large on the part of the U.S. I've had conversations with Andrew Day and Kurt Mills of the American Conservative. The emphases differ on the left and the right. The right is more inclined to emphasize Israel. And the left, by left, I don't mean liberals. I mean the left. They have been less inclined to emphasize Israel. They are more attached to a kind of oil and empire explanation of the Middle East. Now, one thing that's funny is that in the wake of this, I mean, only in the last few days, and in, especially in the wake of the Rubio thing, just regular progressives, okay, not far left, like Tommy Vitor, who does this podcast with Ben Rhodes, have, focused on the Israel explanation, and even in Vitor's case, has condemned the head of the ADL, Jonathan Greenblatt, one of the speech police, who traditionally has said it's anti-Semitic to say Israel wants to draw us into military adventures. Okay, and Tommy Vitor went after Greenblatt, and that's like new. There's those explanations. I the oil thing has never made a ton of sense to me for reasons I could go into, but that doesn't mean it doesn't motivate U.S. policy, because there's a lot of things that don't make sense that do motivate U.S. policy. But there's no doubt that, you know, Israel has played, a big role in shaping our policy in the Middle East. There's a very, collectively powerful array of pro-Israel voices and groups in the U.S. I think in this case, that is part of the explanation. And I think the main other part is just Trump's bizarre psychology. You know, he, as people have noted, he thought Venezuela was a win. That's positive reinforcement. I took the leader out. Man, that was great. Mm-hmm. You know, and remember, he just suffered a loss in Minneapolis where the tough guy thing didn't work and he had to kind of retreat. But the other thing about Trump is, but there's also just the, how am I going to make headlines today, Trump? That gets him into all kinds of, gets him headed down all kinds of roads. But like, remember during the Iranian, there were the protests, and the protests were repressed with a lot of violence.
It sounds like you're pointing to a mix of ego-driven reinforcement.
Oh, wait.
For media dominance. His tendency to prioritize immediate headlines often creates a cycle where long-term strategy takes a backseat to winning the day. During the Iranian tensions in 2020, for instance, the pivot from aggressive posturing to a sudden de-escalation showed that same internal friction between wanting to look tough and avoiding a messy, protracted conflict.
Okay, that was Google's AI that just chose to chime in. I did not ask. I must have said something that triggered it. Okay. So Trump, because he's always got any opportunity to be tough is one to seize. And so he says, whatever he said, if Iran kills protesters, I'll make them pay, or whatever he said.
Right.
And they killed a lot of protesters and he didn't do anything. And he said, well, okay, but if they hang any of them, it was starting to look like, you apparently have not delivered on your earlier threat. But anyway, at that point, he was invested in being tough on Iran. And I honestly think that that got him on the path that led him to a point where, Bibi could give him a little boost and further guidance and, get him to where we are today.
There was also the assassination attempts that I always am confused about why they're not being talked about more. Like, it seemed like it just happens and the next week we move on. But there were the assassination attempts on Trump's, and one of them was... there were stories about it that it was Iran-led. I never saw any proof of that, but it was there in the news cycle, and Trump recently mentioned it. He said something like, they got me.
When was this one? Oh, I didn't hear that. That's so great. when was the supposed... when was the assassination attempt?
Let's see. Trump assassination attempt, Iran.
Yeah. I mean, there's always...
got him before he got me, is the quote.
Mm. You know, they always... Iran gets blamed. You know, they're always... You know, like you may have heard that, like, the reason we have to stop people from coming over the Mexican border is because Hezbollah is behind it and stuff. I mean, there's all these stories, and sometimes there's like some little grain of truth or evidence for them, varying degrees. But, you know, part of there being so much animus toward Iran in the U.S., that's some of it institutionalized, like the Foundation for Defense of Democracies is a think tank just devoted to what has happened now, getting us into war with Iran. And that their experts are routinely quoted in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And you know, so there just is this bias toward getting anti-Iran memes out there. And sometimes they're true, but, and I don't think like FDD would not overtly probably, well, you never know. I mean, those guys are pretty sleazy, but anyway, there are people who want to get this shit out there. You know, look, and there are people who want to get out crazy conspiracy theories about Israel that like go, you know, even beyond the considerable influence that Israel does wield on U.S. foreign policy. So there's a lot of crazy memes out there. But I don't know. That's just
where do you land at the end of the day? Like, what is... Is this a in a longer time scale? Mm. Like, I've been hearing about the possible war with Iran for a few years, and I'm sure I would have heard about it earlier if I paid more attention earlier.
Yeah.
So it's been on the table for some time. What is the U.S. interest in that?
Oh, there's no actual interest. I mean, it's crazy. You know, the interest would be in orchestrating a stable Middle East. That would be America's interest. And it's important to understand that Israel at this point, I think they may have had an interest in that not all that long ago, but Israel has kind of, I think, given up on that. They just want all their neighbors to be too weak to do anything for them because they've concluded that, you know, we're never going to be on really good terms with anyone. They're always going to hate us. We just want to make sure they're weak. I mean, that's why when the new regime took over in Syria, which by all signs was perfectly willing to play ball with Israel,
mm-hmm.
all the cards indicated that. But Israel just decided to proactively attack the country and destroy as much military infrastructure as possible. You know, an egregious violation of international law and so on. This is part of the strategy. And like right now, they're taking advantage of the opportunity to actually seize ground in Lebanon and wipe out capacity there. I personally don't think this is even in Israel's interest long term. But it is now, I think the Israeli leadership now sees it in its interest to just leave neighboring countries in weakness and even disarray to the extent that I think they'd be fine with Iran dissolving into civil war. And I don't think Trump gets that. Like, I mean, who knows? But I saw a report that he's talked to the Kurdish leadership in Iraq, and it sounded as if maybe he's going to encourage a Kurdish insurrection within Iran. I mean, and God knows if he's into it, we'd do what we could covertly, right? If the president decides that. And he is just playing with fucking fire, okay? If he's going to, it cannot be overemphasized how clueless this guy is, how dangerous it is to have him in the White House. But anyway, it's like, where was it? No, it's not in America's interest to do almost any of the last thing that America did in Iran that was in its interest was when Obama got the nuclear deal that did guarantee that they weren't, getting nuclear weapons, had extremely intrusive inspections and monitoring. And of course, Trump pulled out of that in his first term. And here we are. And that, of course, pulling out of it was something that was definitely favored by pro-Israel donors. And Trump, to his credit, has talked openly about how much influence they have, you know, Miriam Adelson and so on.
I had this random thought in preparing for the conversation. I didn't do a lot of preparation because I got, as has been the pattern lately, distracted by all of the other work-related projects that I've got running in Cloud Code. And it's the dynamic of this addiction to Cloud Code is the distance between having an idea and starting to iterate on it is so short. Mm-hmm. And you're running these things in multiple projects in different sessions. And a thought crossed my mind that maybe this, like the feeling that I have of this, like I just can't stop. I'm going to do this here and I'm going to do this. Maybe that's how these power players at the top level feel about, like that's their addiction. And Trump is mm-hmm. said to also be a bit ADD. You know, he's like switching from one thing to another. And it suddenly kind of made sense for a second to me that it's just like, if you have power to just start shit, and then mm-hmm. there will be consequences. And then if you're not happy with the consequences, you'll, you know, have another order issued and there will be more consequences. And you just get dopamine hits from that, from being agentic. You say a thing and something happens in Venezuela and then something happens elsewhere and you can just switch from one to another, to another, to another. That might be just a style of life that keeps you going. It's just like every day there's something new to do. There's major stakes everywhere in the world and you're playing your part. And like what mm-hmm. prevents me from having that approach outside of the Cloud Code thing is like if I'm dealing with people, even in a work environment, even with no stakes, like, you know, people like you have an employee and they get overworked or you don't communicate with them clearly enough and they get less motivated or something. And all of that is complication for me. And I, you know, can't just be doing this, but don't care about this kind of shit. And if you just want things to happen and people in the chain are what to me, you know, the little sessions in Cloud Code is just tools. It's just like your agents. You tell them to do something, they're gonna go and do it. They may fail, but they're gonna go and do it. And you switch to another thing. That might be just a kind of dopamine hit loop yeah. of doing
well, shit. Yeah, I mean, there's another kind of clawed connection to this, which is, well, first I'd say, yeah, I totally agree. I think Trump is like addicted at two levels. Like, again, it's like generating a headline every day. Every day, he's got to get up and say something on social media that gets attention or announce something that gets attention and typically depicts him as this like rough guy, tough guy, truth teller, whatever. There are these several tropes he likes to get out there. So there's that. And I think, again, that's why he had to say, if Iran hurts these protesters, there's going to be hell to pay. He just says shit like this all the time. Okay. In ways that no past president would be so incautious as to do. He just does it all the time. And again, I think that got him on this path. But then you're right. Then there's the second level of addiction of, you know, it's not as frequent a reinforcement schedule. You can't start a war every day. But again, he thinks that Venezuela, he got a dopamine hit for Venezuela. And so that behavior was also reinforced. And so when, you know, after he says this thing and, oh, I guess I should really do something about Iran, then, you know, oh, there's this nuclear thing and there's this thing. And, and you know, Bibi, of course, is encouraging it. And we are where we are. Now, the Claude connection is, I remember thinking, so it was like Friday, I think, that the Pentagon came down hard on Anthropic, right? Mm-hmm. The Pentagon, you know, because Dario Amodei had said, and I think maybe the language is already, I don't know if it was already in the contracts, but he wanted language with their Pentagon contracts that said you can't use their tools for mass surveillance or for fully autonomous weapons. There has to be a human in the decision-making chain. And for whatever reason, the administration came down hard on him. And it was this huge story as of late Friday. It was a lead story on all the papers. And then hours later, you know, the lead story is we we attacked Iran. And I thought, wait, I thought it was just one headline per 24-hour cycle. Like, this is really getting out of control, right? I thought that was a big headline with Anthropic. I mean, are we, this is, so anyway, you know, and it was classic. They are of a piece, honestly. Like, what he did with Anthropic, what did he do wrong? He's just got to be a tough guy every fucking day. And it is so dangerous because he's clueless. He's not very smart. He doesn't understand the world. I don't know what exactly goes on in his head, but I think if it doesn't qualify as in some sense mental illness, we need a new definition of a definition of mental illness. Because I do think there's true delusion. There's true kind of, in some sense, detachment from reality. Like, how could he, I don't know, not have any appreciation of the risks of doing what he did? I don't know.
So if Trump was not in office and somebody like Biden was, would you expect something different?
Well, different from this. But again, Biden helped get us down the slippery slope with his own devotion to Israel. He put our missile defenses entirely at their disposal. I mean, look, if you shield a country from retaliation for an unprovoked attack, you are in effect part of the offense. You are part of the attack, especially here where I really don't think Israel would do it in the absence of that kind of guarantee. So yeah, Biden, no, but this, no, I don't think he would have done this. I don't know how June would have played out with Biden, you know, but Biden was closer to being part of the problem than part of the solution. I mean, in general, not just with respect to the Middle East and Israel, but he had this whole democracy versus autocracy framing of world affairs. I mean, Obama, last guy who I think did anything particularly commendable with respect to the Middle East. And if Trump hadn't undone it in completely gratuitous fashion, we would not be where we are today.
But so you am I hearing this right? The driving force behind all of this is Israel, and America is, for some reason, tied too closely to Israeli interest or Netanyahu's interest to leverage against that, to have their own approach to this.
Well, I mean, there are always a lot of different actors with an interest in conflict. Like, there's always the arms makers. Mm-hmm. What they call the Israel lobby also has, you know, it's not just an ethnic thing. It's not just a Jewish thing. There's, so-called Christian Zionists like Mike Huckabee.
Have you seen clips from his recent appearance on Tucker?
I saw highlights. I mean, I heard the takeaway. It's just mind-blowing. We have never had this level of incompetent, you know, because again, that's just flat-out incompetent. Even Huckabee would recognize that he shouldn't have said that. And you wouldn't have to be very smart to know you shouldn't say that if you're the ambassador to Israel.
And he said, what he said is Tucker asked him, he's saying, you're a Christian Zionist, and part of your logic for why Israel has the right to this land is Genesis, whatever, like God promised this land to them. And he says, I reread the passage recently. It's a much larger portion of the land that God promised them. So do you think Israel should control all of this from, you know, Euphrates to wherever? And he says it would be fine if they took them. They're not asking for it right now, so that we don't need to talk about it. But if they were attacked by somebody and then had a war and then won that war and then acquired land as a result of that, that would be okay.
Yeah, no. He did kind of walk it back. He saw he was in trouble. Give him credit, you know. Like when he stumbles like a total idiot into something, he realizes he stumbled into it. But it's complicated and kind of subtle. There's always so many things at play. I mean, you take somebody like David Sanger, who was, if you go back and look at shit he's written about Iran, you would say, yes, he's part of the problem. But his motivation is complicated because one thing Sanger is great at is just getting his name in the headlines. He just hypes story. He hypes fear. He's a fear monger with respect to China, too. You know, he may have an ideological thing about Israel, but it's hard to say because there are dynamics in journalism that encourage, you know, fear mongering. It sells papers and fear mongering keeps politicians in power. So there are like these generic forces that encourage conflict. And a lot of forces get together and it plays out in very subtle fashion. I wrote a piece for The Intercept, like, I don't know, 8 years ago or something, called Why the New York Times is Making War with Iran More Likely. And the point was, if you look at the way they cover Iran, they just never spend much time on Iran's strategic point of view. They accept the assertion of Israel that, for example, Iran's proxy groups and missiles and any aspiration there may or may not be to develop a nuclear weapon are offensive. Whereas Iran, almost anybody, you know, any serious analyst will tell you that Iran sees a lot of these things as in large part deterrence against attack by the U.S. and Israel. Can't imagine why they'd worry about that, but apparently they think something like that could happen. And that is like a common story. It helped get World War I started, where both sides saw defensive escalation kind of as offensive in intent. And so, you know, once you have succeeded in framing a regime as bad, and I'm not saying, you know, I'm just going to be agnostic on whether Iran or anyone else is good or bad. But there are definitely, you know, influential people in America who want to depict Iran as bad. And I would say they've been pretty successful. Once you've done that, the psychology of it is to read everything they do that might be offensive or defensive as offensive in intent. It's just the way human psychology works. Here we are, but we should probably go into overtime before long. But one more thing about what I think an interesting watershed this is in the discussion of Israel's role is there's this New York Times story that came out, and I think this was maybe it was before, it was certainly in preparation. I think it came out before Rubio said what he said, but in any event, big piece, like what, six bylines, big piece on how Trump decided to go to war. And the first paragraph is, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel walked into the Oval Office on the morning of February 11, determined to keep the American president on the path to war. And this is what Tommy Veter quoted when he said, so fuck you, Jonathan Greenblatt, not in so many words, the head of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, who has made a career of stigmatizing people who would emphasize Israel's role, influence on American foreign policy as anti-Semitic. And it's just, it's significant that the New York Times led the story that way. It's significant that Tommy Veter, who again, he's not some flaming radical. You know, he's a member of the establishment, basically. And, you know, the conversation is changing, but again, Trump has changed it. And, you know, there's one more development or two that I want to talk about, but we should probably go into overtime.
Okay. Let me tease the question that I want to ask you at the beginning of the overtime then. We tried to take a step back and talk about the kind of temporal scale. So this is happening now. Where does it fit in the U.S. foreign policy more broadly? The other similar train of thought that I've been entertaining is we can be talking about this as like U.S. and Israel versus Iran, or it's a broader regional war, or maybe it's a front in a ongoing global conflict where, you know, Iran is a part of, you know, it supplies the drones to Russia, which influences the Ukraine war. On the other hand, U.S. now being involved with Iran is not going to have so many weapons to supply to Ukraine. So where does this fit globally? What consequences is it going to have for other things happening simultaneously?
Yeah, I do want to talk about like where this is heading and where it's likely to head. And I do want to say one more thing about the changing conversation about Israel, especially among American Jews. I think there are big things happening beyond the much noted fact that many younger Jews are alienated from traditional American policy toward Israel. Over time, to get there, you become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter if you're not already one. Link in the show notes and so on. Nikita, you're a master from OSHA. What else would a person say right now?
What else do people get apart from the overtime? We sometimes have something...
Foot massages. Nikita gives foot massages. And what's the other thing?
Pay subscribers to Non-Zero. Should we say this? The Non-Zero Network thing?
Oh, yeah. We started this Non-Zero Network. Our five founding members are the aforementioned Derek Davison, his foreign exchanges Substack newsletter. These are all Substack things. Mark Leanne Goldberg's Global Dispatches. Glenn Lowry's The Glenn Show, Kaiser Guo's Seneca, and Paul Bloom's Small Potatoes. All of those newsletters, folks, if you're a paid subscriber to Non-Zero Newsletter, you get a 50% discount on a paid subscription to any of those. And vice versa, actually. If you're already a paid subscriber to them, you get a 50% discount to us. And for details, there's still a post right at nonzero.org that has this coupon image, you know, 50% off. And the rest is there. That was a good idea. That was a good promotional idea, Nikita.
We'll put a link to that post in the show notes and the video description on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, so... there was also a Sam Harris clip I want to play you. So if people are hungry for Bob getting angry at Sam Harris, that should be in the overtime section.
Now, I think Sam and I have buried the hatchet. No, actually, we haven't. So this should be entertaining. Yes, you should pay to see this, folks. Okay, so we're going in overtime.